It's Friday, December 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. In the next half hour, we'll ask a Rome-based reporter what he thought were the highlights of Pope Francis's annual Christmas Day appeal for world peace. Our South Asia correspondent joins us for a look at why India's Prime Minister made a rare visit to his regional rival and neighbor Pakistan. We'll tell you about a new medical study showing that the Ebola virus has chronic after effects for survivors of the disease. And we'll find out why 2015 was a big year for IMAX and 3D movie technology. It's all ahead on International Edition. Pope Francis has used a Christmas Day speech to tens of thousands of pilgrims at the Vatican to call for peace in the Holy Land and elsewhere throughout the world. The Pope made the plea in his annual Urbi et Orbi message, meaning to the city of Rome and to the world. Christopher Lamb is a Rome-based correspondent for The Tablet, a weekly Catholic journal. Earlier, I spoke to him on the phone and asked him what stood out in the Pope's message.
Well, the Pope was very keen to emphasize the need to bring peace to some of the most conflict-ridden parts of the world, in Syria and in Libya and in sub-Saharan Africa. And he believes that that can be done by emphasizing the need for mercy. This is a big theme for this Pope, and he has instituted a whole year dedicated to the notion of mercy, which he believes can, I think, help bring about peaceful solutions in these desperate parts of the world, often affected by Islamic extremism and kind of interreligious violence.
What does the Pope think people should do to promote this notion of mercy?
So I think what the Pope wants to see is at the personal level, people to show forgiveness and mercy to one another, and then taking it further at the level of international leadership for world leaders and for those in countries where there are conflicts and difficulties, for people to come to an understanding of the other person's position. Mercy is not just giving out forgiveness, it's understanding and relating to someone else and being able to have compassion and empathy with the other person's position. And that's obviously very important when you have kind of intractable conflicts like the Middle East and other countries where there's interreligious conflict. You need to try and understand the other person's position. Obviously, that can be very hard, but the Pope is trying to put forward a kind of a way, something which is idealistic, but I think it can work. And I saw what happened in the Central African Republic when he was there at the end of November, and he went there, and that's obviously a conflict-ridden country with Christian and Muslims fighting each other. And in that country, he called for people to forgive their enemies and to put down their weapons. It was a kind of simple message based on mercy, and I think it has had a small effect.
Well, to what extent did the Pope get political in his views of what should be done to solve global conflicts in today's speech?
Well, he tries to remain neutral in the sense he doesn't want to take sides, but he's certainly political in the sense that he wants to get involved. He doesn't want to just stand on the sidelines, and he doesn't want the church to simply stand idly by while problems go on. So yes, he does speak to world leaders. He does try and facilitate dialogue and compromises, but he's not someone who will take a political position, if you see what I mean. He'll try and do it while maintaining his neutrality.
Okay, well, thank you very much to The Tablet's Rome correspondent, Christopher Lamb, who is actually speaking to us today from London. Thanks for speaking to International Edition.
Thank you.
And now for a look at social media, and let's see what Pope Francis has been tweeting about today. His handle is @Pontifex. That's the handle he uses for English language tweets. And his only tweet of the day today, Christmas Day, is this message: when Christ is your friend, you have joy, serenity, and happiness. A lot of people have been commenting on that tweet. I'll give you a look at some of those comments right now. One from a user named Russ Bergeron. He says, "Merry Christmas, Holy Father. My biggest wish is for everyone to just stop fighting. All of us just need to understand." A more cynical message comes from a Twitter user with the handle @VaporizeCelebs, as in celebrities. He says Pope Francis denounces excessive wealth, vows to give away all of the Vatican's riches to third world nations and the poor, as if. So a little sarcasm there. And then another message that I've seen repeated many times, just wishing the Pope a Merry Christmas. This comes from Michelle Giustiniano. She says, Merry Christmas to you and yours. Have a blessed day filled with love, joy, and happiness. This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
A smartphone, a really smartphone, that will be able to diagnose malaria. Engineers at Texas A&M University are developing a device that attaches to a smartphone and converts it into a sophisticated microscope. Here's Texas A&M's Richard Cote.
The way they diagnose malaria now is with a microscope, but it's a big benchtop microscope, and you have to have the facilities for that scope. So basically what we're taking is that gold standard and making it into a portable device.
The device uses polarized light on a blood sample to detect malaria parasites, and a diagnosis takes just minutes using a phone app. Some 214 million people got malaria in 2015, killing over 400,000, most of those in sub-Saharan Africa. The cost of the device will be under $50, according to the developers. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grossons.
I'm Michael Lippin, and you're listening to VOA's International Edition. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has made a brief surprise visit to Pakistan to meet with his Pakistani counterpart, marking the first such trip by an Indian leader in 12 years. Modi met with Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif at Sharif's family estate near the city of Lahore. Officials said the two leaders talked for about 90 minutes and shared an early evening meal before the Indian leader flew back home. I spoke earlier with our South Asia correspondent Ayaz Gul in the Pakistani capital Islamabad, and I asked him why Modi has made this visit now.
As you know, that this breakthrough, in fact, occurred in Paris when the two leaders, the Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif and the Indian counterpart Narendra Modi, they met on the sidelines and decided to resume bilateral contacts. And then we saw that the Indian foreign minister was able to come to Islamabad earlier this month to attend the Heart of Asia conference that primarily discussed how to promote peace and economic prosperity in Afghanistan. So this is a continuation of that process that we see that on his way back from Afghanistan today, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has decided to make this brief stopover in the eastern Pakistani city of Lahore, where he has just landed and he has come out of the plane, and Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif is at the airport and has received him.
Well, what is the ultimate goal of the leaders of these two countries meeting? Is it actually to resume formal peace talks?
Well, I think the two countries are under pressure, especially from the United States and other international partners, to join hands and promote peace in Afghanistan. I think that is what has brought the two countries together, because with continuing instability in Afghanistan, there are worries that if the traditional tensions between Pakistan and Afghanistan, you know, worsen in the meantime, it will become really a challenge for the international community, which has been trying hard to bring peace to Afghanistan. But if there is tension in this part of South Asia, then obviously, you know, there are allegations that India and Pakistan, in order to increase their influence in Afghanistan, are engaged in some sort of a proxy war there. And that has what worried Afghanistan's international backers and donors, that maybe that conflict should not be allowed to take place on the Afghan soil. Otherwise, things will become much more difficult. So that seems to be the primary objective, because there is also an effort on part of the United States, China, to promote regional connectivity through sort of energy links and, you know, bringing gas from Central Asian regions. And recently, we saw that four nations, Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India together, they inaugurated the construction of this gas pipeline, which will bring gas to Pakistan and then onward to India through Afghanistan from Turkmenistan. So it seems that the economic priorities and using them to bring peace to Afghanistan is what, you know, bringing India and Pakistan closer.
And that was VOA's South Asia correspondent Ayaz Ghul speaking to me from Islamabad. A new study says that the thousands of people who survived the West Africa Ebola epidemic this year may not have returned to full health. The study conducted at an Ebola survivor clinic in Sierra Leone suggests that there are long-term after-effects of the disease, including vision, hearing, and joint problems. VOA's Joe DeCapua has more.
Sharmista Mishra is an infectious disease physician at St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto. She worked at the clinic and is the senior author of the study published in the journal Lancet Infectious Diseases.
So the most prominent after effect were the joint pains, which a lot of times were actually quite severe, causing people not to be able to work or to do some of the normal household things that they needed to do. That was the most frequent one, and we found that about 3/4 of Ebola survivors were experiencing these symptoms.
But that's not all.
The most severe one in terms of affecting and causing disability were the eye symptoms. So about 60% of survivors were complaining of some eye symptoms that started either in the Ebola treatment unit or after they were discharged. And about 18% of them were found to have eye inflammation, and that can lead to vision loss. About half of them at least had severe vision loss already.
On average, Mishra says, Ebola survivors started reporting the symptoms about 2 weeks after being discharged from the Port Loko clinic.
But we've also seen symptoms, at least from this clinic, from the eyes, for example, that began as late as 4 months after discharge.
However, some complained about them even before being discharged. Right now, researchers do not know for sure why these after effects occur, but they have a theory.
It looks like if you had a lot of virus in your blood when you were diagnosed with acute Ebola, that maybe that's associated with developing eye inflammation later. But there's still a lot we don't know about whether it's the virus that's causing this or it's our body's reaction to the virus, our immune system, that's causing these symptoms later on.
It's not clear how long these problems last. Dr. Mishra says an earlier study of Ebola patients in Uganda showed the symptoms can persist for more than 2 years. But only a handful of Ebola cases were reported in Uganda in 2012, compared to the many thousands in West Africa.
This outbreak, the largest in history, huge devastating effects not just on individual health, but on health systems and wider spread beyond that, the economy, the education system. But it also has the opportunity for us to learn as much as possible to prepare for future outbreaks. We should do better, and I think we will, but also to be able to provide the best clinical support we can for those 15 to 17,000 people who survived Ebola.
Dr. Mishra says rebuilding the healthcare systems in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone is a critical next step. She says the Ebola survivor community should play a major role in that process. The clinic in Port Loko, Sierra Leone, was established with the help of the NGOs Partners in Health, Goal Global, and the International Medical Corps. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
If you want to wake up and stay in a good mood all day long, a new study from researchers at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine suggests that you need to get a good night's sleep. Now, that's not necessarily a lot of sleep, but some good quality uninterrupted sleep. The researchers found that being roused from sleep several times a night puts a damper on a good mood more than having a small amount of sleep without any interruptions. Patrick Finnan, the study's lead author and an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Johns Hopkins, says that when your sleep is disrupted throughout the night, you don't have the chance to go through each of the needed various phases of sleep. Not progressing through the stages of sleep can deprive you of the needed slow-wave sleep that is necessary to making a person feel refreshed and restored. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. Well, this year saw a dramatic development in the controversy about same-sex marriage in the United States, with the U.S. Supreme Court issuing a ruling that made it legal throughout the country. Earlier, I spoke to VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman, and I asked him what led up to that major ruling.
Well, Michael, it was a series of court battles, all concerning whether gays and lesbians had the right to marry someone of the same gender. And this is something that had been percolating in the lower courts for quite some time. But after the Supreme Court struck down the federal ban on recognizing same-sex marriage, that seemed to open the door to a lot of legal challenges on a state-by-state basis, whereby couples were saying, we believe we have a constitutional right, and courts were agreeing with them, and it got to the Supreme Court. I was actually at the court to listen to the oral arguments, and I was on the steps of the Supreme Court when the decision came down.
Well, as you were observing the court battle, what were the main arguments for and against?
If you were a same-sex couple, if you're part of a same-sex couple, your argument was that it is simply unfair to be denied a right that everyone else takes for granted. If you are a defender of quote-unquote traditional marriage, the argument is that that allowing people of the same sex to marry fundamentally alters what marriage means, and that can have unintended consequences going for years, decades, generations into the future.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about the day that the decision was made? Because, as you said, you were there.
Yes. Well, no one knew exactly how the decision was going to go. It was pretty much assumed that four of the most conservative justices were going to rule against it, were going to vote against it, against same-sex marriage rights, and the four most liberal judges were going to vote in favor of it. The question came down to Justice Anthony Kennedy. Now, Justice Kennedy had been the deciding vote in overturning the federal ban on same-sex marriage recognition just a couple of years earlier, and he proved to be the deciding vote once again, but no one knew exactly how he was going to vote. And when it came down 5-4, among the same-sex marriage supporters, it was a day that none of them will ever forget.
Well, there are many activists on the religious conservative side of the debate in America who have been strongly opposed to this ruling. What kind of opposition have they been demonstrating in recent months?
Well, you might actually say that considering the landmark decision that now same-sex marriage is performed in all 50 states and territories, including many states where there is a real conservative Christian backlash against any such concept, that the reaction has been fairly muted. I mean, there has been one case of a county clerk in Kentucky who refused to grant same-sex marriage licenses. She was briefly jailed. Then they arrived at some sort of solution where the marriage licenses are being granted by her deputies, but her name doesn't have to appear on it. If that is the worst reaction, I would say that overall the implementation of same-sex marriage has been a huge non-event.
And that was VOA's Michael Bowman. Well, 2015 was a big year for IMAX and 3D movie technology, with almost all big-budget movie productions being offered to cinema-goers in both formats. VOA's Penelope Pulu has this look at some of those films.
Nothing will stand in our way. I will finish what you started.
It's no secret, and even less of a surprise, that Star Wars: The Force Awakens broke the record for the biggest box office debut weekend globally, with ticket sales of $529 million. And that does not include the Chinese markets, where the film debuts on January 9th. According to Zarth Birch, director of theaters and entertainment at Smithsonian, many moviegoers are happy to pay more to watch the film on huge IMAX screens for an all-immersive experience.
They've created this incredible world, and it's this fantasy world that is so endless, so engaging. Of course, it spans multiple generations. I think that IMAX is particularly relevant with the 70mm experience.
And it is not just Star Wars. Before J.J. Abrams' sci-fi blockbuster swept the box office, Jurassic World, the latest in Universal's dinosaur franchise, opened this summer in IMAX and 3D, stomping the competition. On its first weekend, it grossed a breathtaking $525 million. A studio invests in IMAX and 3D formats when it can predict huge profits. Famous movie franchises such as Avengers are a sure bet. Movie lovers prefer to watch high-octane action flicks on huge screens instead of their TV sets. Avengers: Age of Ultron has so far grossed close to $1.5 billion worldwide. The Hunger Games final installment in IMAX and 3D is also among the top grossing films of the year. Pixar's animated IMAX 3D films, The Good Dinosaur and Inside Out, were among this year's top earners, attracting families with their witty scripts, wonderful colors, and masterful animation. But not all IMAX films are successful. Ron Howard's whale of a film, In the Heart of the Sea, about the sinking of the American whaling ship Essex in 1820, an event that inspired the novel Moby Dick, was shot down by the critics as a tale without a soul. This is a good example how the thrill of a story can be lost in the visual extravaganza and technical details. Still, IMAX and 3D formats will continue to do well, offering bigger, brighter, and better stories on huge theater screens. Penelope Kulu, VOA News, Washington.
Well, I'm going to be watching Star Wars on IMAX 3D this weekend, and I'm really excited. I hope you have a chance to see it, too. That's it for International Edition on The Voice of America. My thanks to director Diane Gao and engineer Pete Hundley. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. We'll see you next time.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
In a popular American short story, a young couple, poor but very much in love, frets over what to give each other for Christmas. To buy her husband Jim a chain for his proudest possession, a gold pocket watch, Della sells her proudest possession, her long brown hair, to be made into a wig. Jim finds Della a fine pair of hair combs, but he can pay for them only by trading away his watch. When they exchange gifts and realize what they've done, their now useless presents are all the more precious because of the love and sacrifice they represent. The holiday of Christmas, which millions of Americans and others around the world celebrate today, has inspired many such tales. Some deal with the lessons of generosity and hope, others with the value of friendship, family, and faith. Oddly, one of the most famous, A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, is essentially a ghost story. What they have in common is a spirit of redemption and rejoicing that has long touched the human heart. Tradition is as much a part of the holiday as is its spirit. As in much of the world, millions of Americans will exchange gifts, worship together in their various ways, then gather perhaps with family and friends to complete the celebration over dinner. Many will volunteer to help the homeless, hungry, and others in need. These sentiments transcend nationality, however, and even religion. As the world gets smaller, the Christmas spirit is seen in many places, from Europe to Africa and even Asia. In Japan, Christmas is known more as a time to spread happiness rather than as a religious celebration. Presents and cards are exchanged, and parties are often held for children, with games and dancing. In Madagascar, an island nation off the east coast of Africa, it's summer at Christmas time, but even though it's hot, many homes are decorated in the spirit of the season with holly and imitation snow, even though none of them exist there. The message of peace on earth and goodwill toward men is universal, and one that Americans wish to share at this time of year with all citizens of the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.